So picture a man who is just completely desperate for an answer, right? He's standing before Ali ibn Abi Talib.
Oh, wow. Okay. Starting right at the top.
Yeah, we're jumping right in. And just for context for you listening, Ali is the first imam of Shia Islam, and he is a man who is basically renowned for answering literally any question put to him.
Right, he's the ultimate authority.
Exactly. I mean, he is the person you go to when the theological knot just seems totally impossible to untie.
Yeah, you don't go to him for the easy stuff.
No, not at all. But the thing is, this man approaching him, he doesn't want to know about like ritual or law or anything straightforward. He has this burning question about destiny.
Oh boy, the big one.
The biggest one. He wants to know exactly how much of what we do is us, you know, and how much is already written.
And that is a terrifying question.
It really is. And Ali, who again answers absolutely everything, he does something incredibly unusual here.
Yeah, he doesn't just answer him.
Right. He actually physically tries to
Yeah.
wave the man off, like he dismisses him.
Which is unheard of for him.
Exactly. And I'm going to quote this. He says, quote, "It is a deep ocean. Do not enter it."
You can almost feel the chill in the air when he says that. Do not enter it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a brush off, it's a profound warning.
But the man is he's desperate. So he insists, he pushes forward anyway.
Because of course he does.
Right, human nature. So Ali waves him off a second time and he says, "It is a dark road. Do not tread it."
So the warnings are escalating now.
Oh, definitely.
Because the danger of the question is escalating.
Exactly. But I mean, and the man asks a third time, he just will not let this go.
He is determined to drown.
He really is. So finally, Ali says, quote, "It is a secret of God. Do not burden yourself with it."
Three distinct attempts to protect this man from his own curiosity.
Yeah, three strikes. But the man is totally unyielding.
Which, it basically, because if he can't turn the man away from the water, he has to test him. He has to see if the man's foundation is, like, solid enough to even stand on the shore without drowning.
That makes total sense.
Yeah.
So Ali doesn't actually answer the question about destiny directly.
No, he flips it.
Yeah, he poses a question back to the man. He asks him this, and I'll quote it. "Tell me, was God's mercy to his servants prior to the works of the servants, or were the works of the servants prior to God's mercy?" Now, if you're listening, just pause for a second and think about what's actually happening here. It sounds like a riddle, right?
It does, but it's actually a diagnostic test.
Exactly.
It is the ultimate diagnostic test for a believer's heart. He's essentially asking, what is the very first premise of your universe?
Right.
Like, is it a transaction or is it grace?
Man, that's such a good way to put it. And the man thinks about it and he answers in really the only way that makes sense if you truly believe in a merciful creator.
Yeah.
He says God's mercy came first.
And that is the hinge right there.
Yeah.
Because the moment the man acknowledges that mercy precedes everything, I mean, precedes all human action, all merit, all failure, Ali's entire demeanor just shifts.
Totally changes. He tells the man, quote, "Rise and greet your brother, for he has just become a Muslim who a moment ago was a disbeliever."
Wow. Just like that.
Just like that. One single concession that mercy comes before the work, and Ali declares the entire terrifying matter of destiny completely settled.
The man is saved from disbelief.
He is. But I mean, I think we need to sit with Ali's warning for a minute
Oh,
here.
absolutely.
Because "it is a deep ocean" isn't just like dramatic flair. He meant it quite literally. People really do drown in these philosophical
They
waters.
absolutely do.
They pull on this thread of free will and destiny, and suddenly they just lose their minds or their faith or even their basic sense of morality.
Because when you start pulling on that thread, the entire fabric of how you view reality, how you view justice, your own responsibility, it can all just completely unravel.
Yeah.
It is, without a single doubt, the hardest question a believer in one Almighty God ever has to face.
Which brings us to the actual mission of this deep dive today.
Yes, here we go.
We are stepping into part four of our ongoing exploration of the treatises on divine unity, the text written by the great philosopher Alameh, A Eleme.
And just a quick reminder, as always, out of respect for the tradition, we'll refer to him simply as Elameh. Ah, L.A. May, never his surname.
Right. Thank you for that. So we are tackling Treatise 3 today.
Titled The Divine Acts.
Yes, the Divine Acts. And we are going to walk straight into that exact ocean that Ali warned the man about.
We are putting our boots right in the water.
We really are, because Alameh, Eleme is building this towering philosophical architecture, and it leads to this totally unavoidable precipice.
It really does.
And to understand just how steep this drop is, let's briefly look at the foundation we've laid so far.
Okay, let's recap.
So in our previous deep dives, we established a core idea. God is not just a really powerful being floating out there among other beings.
No, God is being itself, capital B.
Right. So every single perfection you possess, whether that's, you know, power, knowledge, life, beauty, none of it is truly yours.
None of it. You're holding borrowed light.
Borrowed light. I love that phrase. But now, in this treatise, Eleme, basically draws the blade all the way out.
Yeah, it doesn't hold back.
He opens with what has to be the most startling, blunt premise in the entire book.
Mm-hmm.
He claims that the only real agent of any act anywhere in the universe is God.
Okay, we really need to unpack this.
Yes, we do. Because my immediate reaction, and I'm sure your reaction listening right now, is just visceral discomfort.
Absolutely.
Wait, if God is the only real agent, the actual doer of every act,
yeah.
Does that mean God is the doer of every cruelty, every betrayal, every genocide, every single time someone lies or steals or breaks another human being? Is Eleme actually saying God did that?
Well, see, he is not saying God permits it.
Okay.
And he's not saying God set the clockwork in motion and stepped back. Right.
He is saying that once you strip away all the limitations, the real doer of the act is God.
I have to push back on this.
Go ahead.
Because that feels fundamentally wrong. It feels like it breaks the very definition of a good and just God.
It really does feel that way.
Like, if a man strikes an innocent person and God is the doer of that act,
Yeah. Then
the word justice just completely loses all meaning.
It does. And Eleme knows this.
Okay, so he's not just oblivious to the problem.
Not at all. He is fully aware of the massive theological collision he is setting up here.
Right.
But he isn't inventing this tension just to be, like, edgy or provocative.
Okay.
He is trying to untie a paradox that is sitting right there glaring at us in the text of the Quran itself.
Wait, because the scriptures aren't exactly shy about this contradiction, are they?
Exactly. The absolute core of the paradox, the knot that Eleme is laser focused on, is found in Quran chapter 4, verses 78 and 79. And just to point out, these verses are right next to each other.
Literally one breath apart.
Yeah.
I'm going to quote them slowly. Verse 78 says, quote, "Say, all is from God."
Okay. All is from God. That's absolutely, it's comprehensive.
Right. And then the very next verse, 79, says, quote, "Whatever good befalls you is from God, and whatever evil befalls you is from yourself."
It gives you metaphysical vertigo.
It really does.
First breath, everything is from God.
Yeah.
Second breath, well, the good is from God, but the evil is from you.
Exactly.
How can both of those statements occupy the exact same reality? I mean, how can God be the doer of everything, but not the author of the evil that you do?
That is the million-dollar question.
Yeah.
And what's really fascinating here is that to resolve this, Eleme, doesn't try to soften God's power.
He doesn't take the easy way out.
No. He doesn't say, well, God only does most things and leaves the bad stuff to us.
Right, right.
Instead, to reconcile how God can be doer of everything, yet not the author of evil, we have to completely, radically redefine what we think evil actually is.
Okay, so what is it? Because when I think of evil, I think of a positive force.
Sure.
Like, a punch in the face feels like a very real positive force. It transfers kinetic energy. Yeah. It leaves a physical mark.
Right.
It feels like an added ingredient in the universe.
And this is exactly where Eleme, introduces a concept that he inherits and refines from a very deep philosophical tradition.
Okay.
It's called the privation theory of evil.
The privation theory.
Yeah. The core idea is that evil, considered precisely as evil, is not a substance.
Wait, what do you mean?
I mean, it has no physical mass. It has no metaphysical energy. It is entirely a lack.
A privation.
A lack.
Yes.
It is a gap where good should have been, but just isn't.
A gap. But again, a bullet flying through the air is real. The pain is real.
The bullet is real.
Right.
The kinetic energy is real. Mm-hmm. The firing of the gunpowder is real.
Okay.
All of those things are existence. They are being.
Oh.
And as being, they trace back to God.
Okay. I follow that.
But what makes the event evil? The evil is the disruption of the living tissue.
Oh.
It is the absence of the health and the wholeness that ought to belong to that human body.
Ah. Okay. So the wound on your arm isn't an object that was like added to you.
No.
The wound is torn tissue. It's literally the absence of the wholeness that was there before.
Exactly. Look at what we actually label as evil in the moral world. Cruelty.
Okay.
What is cruelty?
Mm-hmm.
It isn't a substance you can bottle up.
Right.
It is the absence of the mercy that ought to be present in that interaction.
Yeah, that's a shift in perspective.
It is. Injustice isn't a thing you can weigh on a scale. It's the missing fairness.
Yeah.
Blindness is not a dark veil placed over the eyes. Blindness is simply the absence of sight in a creature that, by its very nature, ought to see.
Oh.
None of these are positive ingredients added to reality. They are gaps. Things not there.
Okay, I have a visual for this that I want you to hold on to for this entire discussion, if you're listening.
I love a good visual.
Think of a beautifully knitted wool sweater.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
But right in the middle of the chest, there is a gaping hole.
Right.
Now let's look at the sweater. The wool itself is 100% real. You can touch it. You can feel its warmth. It has texture and weight.
Yeah, it exists.
And every single thread of that wool comes from the maker.
Right. The maker sourced the material. They dyed it. They knitted it together. The maker is the absolute agent of the sweater's existence.
Right. But here is the crucial part. The maker did not knit a hole.
No.
You cannot knit a hole. You can't hand someone a hole in a box.
That's physically impossible.
Exactly. The hole is precisely where the wool isn't. The hole is the lack of the maker's work.
That is a phenomenal way to ground this.
It helps, right?
It really does. Because if we apply that analogy back to the baffling Quranic paradox, it suddenly just snapped into focus.
Okay, walk me through it.
The being of any act, the energy it takes, the physical existence of the moment, the raw reality that something is happening at all, that is the wool.
The wool?
Yes. That is real. And all reality, all existence is from God.
So if I raise my hand to strike someone,
yeah,
the functioning of my muscles, the firing of my neurons, the existence of the air my hand moves through, that's all wool.
That's all wool.
That's all God's sustaining power.
Yes. The raw existence of the action is from the source of all being.
Right.
But the deficiency in that act, the missing rightness, the lack of mercy, the distortion of justice that turns just raising a hand into an act of violence.
That is whole.
That is the whole.
Yeah.
And that whole, that privation, is the evil.
Wow.
And because it is a lack, it isn't authored by anyone. You don't create a lack.
Right. You can't build an empty space.
Exactly. The lack belongs entirely to the limited, flawed creature where the good ran out.
So when verse 78 says, say, all is from God, it's talking about the wool.
Precisely.
It's talking about everything that has actual reality.
Yes. And when the very next breath says, whatever evil befalls you is from yourself, it's talking about the whole.
The failure.
The failure of the creature to hold the light, to sustain the goodness. It's a profound asymmetry of existence.
There is a quote from the eighth Imam, Al-Rida, that perfectly captures this asymmetry.
Oh, I know the one.
Yeah. I'm going to read this slowly as a quote because it's so tightly constructed.
Please do.
It is framed as God speaking directly to the human being about this exact dynamic. He says, quote, whatever good befalls you is from God, and whatever evil befalls you is from yourself. For I am more entitled to your good works than you are, and you are more entitled to your evil works than I am.
Let's really look at the mechanics of that phrasing.
Yeah, let's break it down.
I am more entitled to your good works than you are. Why?
Why?
Because any goodness in your work is real. And all reality, all perfection, belongs to God.
Right.
You are just borrowing the wool to make a good pattern. The goodness is his.
And you are more entitled to your evil works than I am.
Exactly.
Because the evil is the part where you fail to continue the pattern.
Yeah.
The deficiency, the drop-off, the failure that belongs to the limited creature. God cannot be the author of evil because evil isn't a thing that exists to be authored.
No, it's not.
It is simply where the creature's capacity failed.
It is an incredibly elegant philosophical solution.
It really is.
God is the absolute agent of everything that is, while remaining entirely blameless for what fails to be.
The sweater is real. The hole is just your failure to hold the thread.
Perfectly said.
Okay, I follow the logic there. I really do.
But
wait.
There's always a but.
Yeah, if God knits all the wool, doesn't that mean the size, the shape, and the ultimate pattern of the sweater is already decided?
Yes.
Like, if every drop of actual existence comes from the definitive decree of the maker, does that mean the future is just fixed?
Right.
Are we just wearing a garment that was already completely finished before we even took our first breath?
This is exactly the next logical cliff we have to look over.
It feels like a sheer drop.
It does. We have to confront the nature of destiny itself. Or, in the terminology of the tradition, kada, kadie, and kwadar, kadar.
Kada, kadidai, and kwadar. Because if every action traces back to God's reality, it really, really feels like we are just actors hitting marks on a stage.
Reading a script?
Yeah. We're reading a script that was finalized ages ago. And again, the scriptures actually seem to support this.
They do.
The Quran constantly talks about things being recorded in a manifest book before they even happen.
It does. And if you only read those verses and you don't read them philosophically, you end up with a very flat, very suffocating view of predestination.
Suffocating is the right word.
You end up totally paralyzed.
Yeah.
But Alama, Alama, argues that people get hopelessly tangled up here because they collapse two entirely different layers of reality into one.
Okay, so how does he separate them? I need to know how to untangle this.
He introduces a visual of how anything in the physical world comes to be.
Okay.
Think of it like a funnel.
A funnel.
Yeah. Let's trace your existence sitting here right now, backward through time.
Okay, going backward.
Before you were the person listening to this deep dive, you were a child. Before that, an infant. Before that, an embryo.
And before that, just genetic potential, right? Food my parents ate, plants, minerals, stardust.
Exactly, stardust. Now, at that elemental stage, at the very wide top of the funnel, that specific bit of carbon and water could have become almost anything.
Sure.
Thousands upon thousands of futures were genuinely open to it.
Right, it could have become a tree.
A tree, a bird, a drop of rain in the ocean.
But with each step forward in time, the funnel narrows. Yeah. The matter becomes a plant. Well, now it can't be stone anymore. That door is closed.
Exactly.
It becomes food. It becomes an embryo. With every single transition, a massive class of possibilities is just shut down.
Shut down completely.
The options get fewer and fewer, tighter and tighter, until finally it becomes you, fully formed, sitting right where you are.
And here is the philosophical absolute that governs reality.
Okay.
Once you actually exist as you, fully actualized in the present moment, it is absolutely impossible for you to simultaneously be a tree.
Well, yeah, because I am already me.
Yes. What blocks the change at the very end of the funnel isn't some arbitrary magical rule imposed by God.
Right.
It is simply the nature of being fully real. What actually is cannot at the exact same time not be.
Okay. So how does this help us with the terrifying idea of a fixed destiny?
It shows us that every single event in the universe has two distinct ranks or layers behind it.
Two layers.
The first rank is the bottom of the funnel.
Okay.
The rank where things are fully actual, finished, fixed, and no longer open to being otherwise.
Right. The you cannot be a tree rank.
Yes. Alameh calls this the definitive decree. In Arabic, kada kada alhatmi.
Kada kada alhatmi. The definitive decree. The finished reality.
Yes. But then there's the second rank.
Okay.
This is the rest of the funnel.
Everything above the bottom.
Exactly. The rank of half-formed things, the partial causes, the open possibilities that haven't yet reached the bottom.
Right.
At this level, things genuinely can still go in more than one direction.
Because they aren't fully formed yet.
Right. The environmental factors, the human choices, the prayers, they were all still swirling.
Swirling in the funnel.
Yes.
Mm.
This level of determination or measuring out is called kudar.
Kadar. Kadar, kadar. Okay, I love thinking about this as a book. Let's translate this funnel into like a publishing house.
Well, let's do it.
Think of the universe and your life within it as a massive book that is currently in the process of being produced.
Okay.
Kada, kada, that definitive decree that is the pages that have already been run through the heavy iron printing press.
The ink is dry.
Exactly. You cannot unprint them. What happened yesterday is kada kada. It is fixed forever.
But kadar represents the draft pages.
The drafts.
The manuscript that is still sitting on the editor's desk. It has shape. It has a trajectory. But the ink is wet.
It's open to edits.
It is genuinely open to edits.
And this distinction completely reorients how we understand divine intervention. And frankly, why we even bother praying?
It really does.
Because in the Islamic tradition, there is this profound concept called bada badie. It translates roughly to God's change of plan.
Right.
You hear these incredible stories where a terrible fate was destined for someone, like a fatal accident was looming.
Mm-hmm.
But they gave charity that morning, or they prayed deeply, and the fate was averted.
Which normally makes a skeptic ask, wait, did God not know what was going to happen?
Right.
Did he make a mistake and have to use cosmic whiteout on the master plan?
Yes. I always struggled with that. If God knows everything, how can he change his mind?
Because with a book analogy, bada, bada, yeah,
yeah,
makes perfect sense without compromising God's omniscience.
How so?
When God averts a fate, he is not pulling a printed page out of the bound book and furiously erasing it. He is revising a page that was always still in draft.
Wow.
The change happens in the realm of Kadar,
yeah,
where things are measured out but not yet finalized.
So it's real change. The prayer really mattered. The charity actually shifted the trajectory.
Yes.
But it only shifted things in the layer where the ink was still wet.
There's a tradition from Imam Al-Rida that maps out exactly how an event moves from the wet ink to the dry ink.
Okay, what is it?
He breaks it down into four distinct stages of causality.
Four stages.
First, God's attention turns to a thing. The possibility is recognized.
Okay.
Second, the will completes.
Right.
Third, the measuring out. This is the Qadar.
Qadar. The measuring out.
This is where the event is given its length, its breadth, its specific duration and constraints in the physical world.
It's being formatted for the page.
Yes.
The margins are being set.
Exactly. Formatting, but not yet printed.
Okay.
And then comes the fourth stage.
Yeah.
The decree, the Qadar. Qadiyah. And Imam Al-Rida specifically calls this final stage the stage that admits no turning back.
So when the Quran says your life is in a book before we bring it into being, that is entirely true of the printed pages.
Absolutely true.
But it is fundamentally false to assume that every page of your future is already sitting in the printed stack.
Right.
Part of your life is written. Part of it is still being written right now. And telling the difference between the two is basically the definition of wisdom.
Knowing what you must accept with grace, because it is kata, katiore, and what you must fiercely fight to shape, because it is still Qadar.
Okay. That gives me immense relief about my day-to-day choices.
It's very freeing.
My present life is a mix of printed reality and open drafts.
Yeah.
But, unfortunately, this forces us to confront an even deeper, much more uncomfortable anxiety.
I know exactly where you're going.
What about the core of who we are?
Yeah.
Sure, I can choose what I eat for breakfast or whether I drive fast or slow in the open pages of Qadar.
Right.
But what about my actual soul? Was my capacity for good or evil, my very nature, printed as good or evil from the very beginning?
You are stepping right into the deepest, darkest water of the entire text.
I mean, we have to go there.
We do. And I have to say, we need to handle this with extreme care.
Okay.
Because the surface reading of the material we are about to discuss sounds like the harshest, most unforgiving predestination imaginable.
That sounds monstrous.
It does. And it is vital to state right up front. Alame, himself, in his own voice, explicitly says that the fatalistic surface reading is absolutely wrong.
Okay, good. That's a relief.
But we have to look at what the tradition actually says before we can understand how he rescues it.
Right. We have to look at the text. So the tradition speaks of something called essential felicity and essential wretchedness.
Yes.
And just as defined terms, saada, is felicity, right? Being fundamentally aligned with the good, destined for paradise.
All right.
And shakawa, is wretchedness, being essentially ruined, destined for hell.
And there is a very famous, very heavy saying of the prophet regarding this.
Let's hear it.
He said, quote, "The wretched is the one who was wretched in his mother's womb. And the felicitous is the one who was felicitous in his mother's womb."
Just let that sit for a second. Wretched in his mother's womb.
Yeah.
That is a terrifying phrase.
It gets heavier.
Oh, great.
There is an entire genre of hadith reports from the prophet and the imams that talk about Tina, native clay. The literal constitution of your soul.
Wow.
These reports say that the people of felicity were drawn from a beautiful clay, a clay of light, of sweet water, from the soil of paradise itself.
Okay.
And the people of wretchedness were drawn from a clay of darkness, a foul, bitter water, from the soil of the fire.
And the Quran uses this kind of imagery too, right?
It does.
It talks about two seas, one sweet and one salty, with a barrier between them.
Yes.
It talks about rain falling the exact same rain, but when it falls on good soil, it yields fruit, and when it falls on foul soil, it yields nothing but weeds.
Now, if you take all of this flatly, literally.
If I take this flatly, I cannot reconcile it with a just God.
Right.
It sounds like God literally stamps some babies with the word hell and others with the word heaven before they even take a breath.
It really does.
It makes the entire moral drama of human life look like a rigged game. Mm-hmm. A cruel theater where the actors are sweating and crying, having no idea the ending was decided by the director in the prop room before the curtain even went up.
And this is exactly the moment where Alame, firmly and definitively plants a guardrail.
Thank goodness.
He rejects this fatalistic reading entirely.
So how does he explain it?
He argues that if essential wretchedness meant a fixed at birth, inescapable verdict, then the entire structure of religion collapses into absurdity.
Right. What would be the point of sending prophets to warn people?
Exactly.
What would be the point of parents agonizing over how to raise their children well?
Religious obligation, moral training, repentance, all of it would be completely futile.
Totally pointless.
Furthermore, reward and punishment would be a cosmic injustice.
Yeah.
You can't throw a machine in the fire for doing exactly what you programmed it to do. Says God is infinitely just, so that cannot be what these traditions mean.
Okay, if I can't take native clay literally without breaking God's justice, then clay has to be a metaphor for something we build ourselves.
Yes.
But how do you build something in the womb? How does he read these traditions?
He says that character is built, not imposed.
Built, not imposed.
Your soul does indeed start with a specific constitution. It starts soft, deeply tinged by your physical body, your genetics, your temperament, your early environment.
Okay, that makes sense.
He's very honest about this. He calls it a loaded die. It is not a purely blank slate.
A loaded die. That makes psychological sense.
Right.
Some people are born with a propensity for addiction or a shorter temper or naturally sunny disposition.
Yes.
The die has a weight on one side. It has a tendency to roll a certain way.
Yes, but a loaded die is not a written script.
Oh, that's good.
The loading is real and it makes certain paths harder or easier. But Alame, is adamant that spiritual training genuinely works.
You can fight it.
You can fight the loaded die. You can choose to roll against the weight.
So the clay is just our starting point. But where does the essential part come in? Why call it essential wretchedness if it's just a tendency?
Because of what happens over the course of a lifetime.
Okay.
Choice by choice, habit by habit, the soft clay of your soul begins to harden.
Like firing clay in a kiln.
Exactly. Every time you lie, you carve a groove into that clay. Every time you show mercy, you reinforce a structure.
Wow.
You are literally firing the clay of your own soul in the kiln of your daily choices.
That is a powerful image.
Eventually, these dispositions harden into deeply ingrained patterns. The tradition calls these hardened traits malakat.
Malakat.
Yes. And late in the process of a human life, those malakat set into a stable form that can no longer easily be effaced.
They become locked in.
It becomes who you fundamentally are.
Yeah.
That settled, hardened form is your essential self.
Okay.
So when the tradition speaks of essential wretchedness, it is naming that final hardened shape of the soul.
The weight.
But it is describing it from the inside, reading the story backward from the end to the root.
Wow. Okay, so the clay isn't a barcode scanned at birth.
No.
It's the finished statue at the end of your life.
Exactly. It's the destiny the soul becomes, not a sentence imposed upon it from the outside.
That flips it completely.
When the Hadith push the language all the way back into the womb, they are trying to communicate that the roots of who you become run astonishingly deep.
You're right.
Deeper than your fleeting conscious choices. Hmm. They run into the very grain of your being.
Right.
But you participated in the hardening of that grain.
That reframes the terror into a profound sense of responsibility.
It really does.
I am holding the wet clay right now, but wait.
Yeah.
If those roots run so deep that the prophet speaks of them being present in the womb, where do they actually trace back to? Like, right. If it's not just the biological role of the dice, where did the die get loaded?
This is where Alame opens a door to something truly breathtaking.
Okay, I'm ready.
He traces the loading of the die to something the soul itself actually did.
The soul did it.
Yes. Hmm. But it did it before this physical world even began.
Wait, before the physical world?
Yes.
Yay.
He grounds this in one of the most mysterious and beautiful passages in the entire Quran. It's chapter 7, verse 172.
Okay.
I'm going to read the translation slowly because the imagery is striking.
Please do.
Quote, "And when your Lord took from the children of Adam, from their loins, their seed, and made them bear witness against themselves, am I not your Lord? They said, yes, indeed, we bear witness.
Am I not your Lord? Yes, indeed. A pre-worldly scene.
The tradition calls this the realm of particles. Or Alam Aldar.
Alam Aldar. Now, I've heard modern interpretations of this, and a lot of people just say, oh, that's just a poetic metaphor.
Right. They try to soften it.
Yeah. They say it just means human beings are born with a natural instinct to search for meaning or a biological hardwiring for religion.
And Alame, Alame, pushes back on that completely.
Brett?
He absolutely rejects that it's just poetry. And his reasoning is incredibly sharp.
What's his reasoning?
He points to the rest of that very same verse.
Okay.
The verse explicitly says this testimony was taken so that on the day of resurrection, human beings could not use one of two specific excuses.
Two excuses?
Yes. They couldn't say, we were heedless of this, meaning we didn't know any better. Or, we only followed our fathers, meaning it was just our culture. We were brainwashed.
Okay, let me play the skeptic here for a second.
Go for it.
If this was just a metaphor for normal earthly self-awareness, that might cut off the first excuse.
Right.
You can't say you were completely heedless if you have a functioning brain and eyes to look at the stars.
Exactly.
But normal earthly life absolutely does not cut off the second excuse.
No, it doesn't.
We do follow our fathers. We are massively, inescapably shaped by our cultures, our families, and the zip codes we are born into.
Exactly. If your only exposure to truth is through the messy, biased lens of human history and family lineage, you have a perfectly valid excuse on the Day of Judgment.
Right. You could say to God, I was born into a society that taught me violence was good. How was I supposed to know?
Yes. But Alameh, says the verse insists this excuse is invalid. Why?
Why?
Because there was a real, pre-worldly, entirely individual standing before God.
A moment where you were stripped of your family name, your culture, your historical era.
Yes.
You stood as a solitary consciousness.
In the Alameh Maldar, the souls existed as shadows.
Shadows.
Not yet thickened into physical bodies, not yet bound by time or geography, but fully spiritually aware.
Wow.
And in that realm, every single soul answered for itself.
Hold on, you're telling me I made my most fundamental moral choice before I even had a brain?
Yes.
Before I had a prefrontal cortex to weigh consequences? How is a shadow supposed to make a choice? How is that not just predestination with extra mystical steps?
It's a huge leap, I know. It requires us to decouple consciousness from biology.
Okay.
In this philosophy, the soul is the primary reality, and the body is just the vehicle it drives in the physical world.
The soul drives the body.
Yes. The shadow self isn't a ghost lacking a brain. It is the pure essence of your awareness, unclouded by physical appetites or fatigue.
It's the truest me.
It is your truest self. And in that state of absolute clarity, standing in the undeniable presence of its creator, it responded.
That is heavy.
It is.
But you know, it connects to something so deeply human.
What's that?
Think about a specific experience you've probably had. Have you ever walked into a room, locked eyes with a total stranger, and felt an immediate, unexplainable affinity?
Oh, absolutely.
Like you've known them for 1,000 years? Or the exact opposite, you meet someone who is perfectly polite, completely appropriate, but your spirit violently recoils from them, and you cannot articulate why.
It is a universal human experience.
Mm.
And the Shia tradition provides a stunning explanation for it.
What is it?
Imam al-Sadiq says that in that pre-worldly realm, the souls that recognized each other and aligned with each other there clave together.
They clave together.
And the souls that did not recognize each other parted company.
So when you meet that stranger, you aren't meeting them for the first time.
No.
You are encountering a resonance from the Alameh Maldar. Those affinities have a root far older than your birth certificate.
And this explains the clay and the essential wretchedness we struggled with earlier.
How so?
Because in that pre-worldly realm, a deep sorting took place. The hadith describe it happening in stages. The souls were called to acknowledge God, and all of them did.
All of them.
That is the baseline, yes.
But then it goes deeper, right?
It does. Then they were called to acknowledge the prophets, and here, some hesitated, some refused.
Wow.
Finally, they were called to the walaya, wa'alaya.
Wa'alaya. The spiritual allegiance to the prophet's family, the guides of humanity.
Yes. And it was here that the deepest division fell. The souls revealed their truest orientations.
This is wild.
So when you see someone in this worldly life, utterly entrenched in unbelief or cruelty or arrogance, the tradition suggests this isn't just a random failing.
Right.
The Quran says of certain people, they could not believe in what they had denied before.
Denied before, meaning before they were even born.
Exactly. Their earthly unbelief is simply the playing out, the temporal unfolding in slow motion of a profound no that they already spoke in that pre-worldly realm. Wretchedness isn't God's caprice or cruelty. It is the soul's own deepest, most authentic orientation, fully realizing itself in time.
The soul chose its posture before the clock started ticking.
Yes.
But wait, If my pre-worldly shadow self already said no, am I just doomed? Where's the mercy in this?
The mercy is in the baseline.
The baseline.
Remember the first stage of the sorting? All souls acknowledged God. All of them said the initial yes.
Right, right.
And Alame, L-A-M-A, points out a beautiful, merciful hinge here. In this physical world, you can ruin your life.
Yeah.
Heedlessness can fall over you. Your heart can become hard. Your eyes and ears can be spiritually sealed by your own bad choices.
The layers of the world can basically bury you. The trauma, the pain, the distraction.
Yes. But the soul's vision of itself and through itself, its vision of the Lord that sustains it, is never fully veiled.
Never fully veiled.
Even the most lost, broken, hardened person on earth, in the absolute deepest layer of their self-awareness, knows that they are not self-sustaining.
Right.
They know they are held in being by another.
That buried, quiet knowing, that is the covenant.
That is the covenant.
Mm-hmm.
It is still in you, under the noise, under the trauma. Under the hardened clay.
Whoa.
You may have forgotten the visual scene at the Alamaldar, but you have not entirely forgotten the yes. It is always there, vibrating at the core of your existence, waiting to be remembered.
That is incredibly beautiful.
Yeah.
So if our deepest spiritual posture was chosen before time began, and if God is the ultimate agent weaving the wool of reality,
right.
What does that actually mean for the mechanics of the choices we make today? Right now.
Yeah.
Are we just puppets dancing on strings we can't see, or do we actually steer the ship?
This brings us to the climax of the entire problem.
Right.
Neither a puppet nor a god, because Alame, Alame, has to show us how we actually live in this tension without drowning.
Right. Back to the ocean.
Exactly. He starts by outlining the two traps, the two extreme positions where almost everyone ends up failing when they try to answer this.
The two ways people drown in Ali's ocean.
The first trap is called Tafweed. This translates to delegation.
Tafweed,
delegation.
This is the position that says, God created us, gave us our bodies and our brains, wound us up like clockwork toys, and then completely handed over the moral world to us.
He stepped back.
He might know what we're going to do, but he doesn't act in our acts. The deeds are entirely 100% ours.
I'll be honest, that sounds incredibly appealing to a modern ear.
It really does.
It completely rescues human freedom.
Yeah.
We are totally in charge of our own destiny.
It does rescue freedom, but at a catastrophic theological price.
What's the price?
Because if Tafweed is true, God becomes a mere spectator. Sovereignty leaks out of the universe.
Oh.
There are entire realms of reality, human history, human action, where God is powerless, just watching things happen from the balcony. God is no longer the sustainer of all being. He's just the initiator.
Okay, so Tafweed makes us independent little gods and turns the creator into an audience member.
Yes.
That breaks the foundational premise of everything we've learned so far.
It does.
What's the other trap? The other extreme is Jab. JBR.
Yeah.
Compulsion.
Jabba.
Compulsion.
This position looks at God's absolute power and says, well, if God is the only power, then human choice must be a total illusion.
Okay.
We are basically meat puppets. Every time I raise my hand, every time I speak a word, it's just God directly pulling a string.
Well, that rescues God's sovereignty completely, right? Nothing happens without him doing it.
But look at the price. It makes the entire moral life a sham.
Yeah.
Obligation, reward, punishment. It all becomes an empty, terrifying pageant. Because if JBR is true, God is unjust.
Because he's punishing us for what he did.
Exactly. He is throwing puppets into the fire for dancing to the exact strings he pulled. He is punishing people for acts he committed through them.
So Tafweed destroys God's power, and JBR destroys God's justice.
Exactly. And the imams of the Shia tradition firmly, repeatedly reject both.
So what's the alternative?
They offer a formula that was transmitted so many times it basically became the defining motto of Shia theology.
Let's hear it. They said, quote, there is no compulsion and no delegation. Rather, a matter between the two matters. In Arabic, Amr Baina Amrain.
Amr Baina Amrain.
Amr between the two
matters.
Now, when I hear between the two, my mind immediately goes to a compromise. Like a 50-50 split.
Sure, it's natural.
Like, God does half the work, I do half the work, I push the car, God steers.
But that is fundamentally misunderstanding it.
Okay, correct me.
When someone asked the imams if this middle way was just a hair's breadth compromise, a blending of the two, the answer was beautiful.
What did they say?
They said, quote, yes, wider than the distance between heaven and earth.
Wow.
It is not a mathematical fraction. It is a vast, unexplored country of metaphysics.
I need to understand how this works. How can my act be entirely dependent on God's power using 100% of his wool, yet genuinely fully free.
Elema, all Elema, uses an analogy that is so precise it's bracing.
I love analogies. Hit me. He asks us to look at the fundamental mechanical difference between a fire that burns a log and a human being who chooses to laugh at a joke.
Okay. Well, the fire doesn't choose anything. It just burns because it's fire. The human decides to laugh.
True. But think about it mechanically. Once the oxygen, the heat, and the wood are present, the fire necessarily burns.
Right.
The causes compel the effect. It cannot withhold its burning.
Okay.
But here is the kicker. Once the human hears the joke, understands the context, finds it funny, and their neurological system aligns, the laugh also necessarily happens.
Oh.
In both cases, when the complete set of causes is present, the effect must follow.
Wait, if they both happen necessarily when the causes align, where is the freedom? You're making it sound like the human is just a very complicated chemical fire.
The difference is not whether causality exists. The difference is the type of cause.
The type of cause. The
fire is a blind physical cause. It has no internal space.
What?
But human choice is a highly specific, special kind of cause. It is a cause that runs through knowledge, awareness, and deliberation.
Through awareness.
Your choice isn't a magical glitch that defies the laws of cause and effect. It is a cause that passes through a knowing mind.
Ah, so the freedom isn't about breaking causality. It's about participating in it consciously.
Exactly. At the moment of deliberation, your relationship to doing the act or not doing the act remains genuinely open to you.
I feel the friction.
You do. Both futures are really possible in your mind. And that openness, running through your awareness, weighing the options, feeling the friction of the choice, that is exactly what freedom is.
Wow.
God sustains your existence. He sustains the world around you. He gives you the power to choose. But you are the one deliberating.
So it's fair to judge me.
Yes. And because you weighed it and chose it, that is exactly what makes holding you obligated and accountable completely fair.
Elema, says we know this in our bones, don't we? We don't need a philosophy degree to feel the difference.
We do. He points out that you effortlessly know the difference between the steady, deliberate step of a healthy person walking across a room and the involuntary tremor of someone with a palsy.
Both are physical movements. Both require energy, the wool. Both trace back to God's sustaining power.
Yes. But one runs through the conscious deliberating self and the other bypasses it. No one confuses sitting perfectly still by choice with being physically paralyzed.
Right.
We know what an act of freedom feels like from the inside.
And Imam al-Sadiq gave us an incredibly practical way to apply this in our daily lives, didn't he?
He did.
A pocket test for navigating this exact tension. I call it the blame test.
The blame test. I love that.
Yeah, the Imam basically says, look at the thing you are wondering about. Can you fairly be blamed for it?
Let's apply it. Can you be blamed for your height?
No. I didn't choose to be this tall. If someone yells at me for being short or tall, they're being ridiculous.
Therefore, your height is God's act. It is a manifestation of his quota, his definitive decree. You just accept it. Now, can you be blamed for telling a lie to your friend to save face?
Absolutely. I knew the truth. I deliberated. I felt the friction. And I chose to speak a falsehood. I am entirely to blame.
Therefore, the lie is your act.
My act.
The line between your acts and God's acts runs exactly along the line of what you can fairly be blamed for. Your sins are yours. Your height, your heartbeat, the weather that is God's.
It is clean. It is usable. And it cuts through the philosophical fog perfectly.
It really is clarifying.
But within this freedom, within our terrifying ability to choose and be blamed, the tradition places a massive warning sign.
Yes, because the most dangerous thing about having true freedom is that you can be lulled out of using it.
Yeah.
You can fall asleep at the wheel while driving 80 miles an hour.
The tradition calls this concept istidraj, istidraj, the slow rope.
Istidraj is tidraj. The Quran talks about certain arrogant people and says, quote, we shall lead them on by degrees from where they do not know.
By degrees.
They're being drawn out by slow stages.
I want to share a personal thought on this, because Imam al-Sadiq's explanation of istidraj, is tidraj, is chilling precisely because it is so incredibly ordinary.
Please share.
He says, istidraj, istidraj, is when a person commits a sin, and immediately afterward, a fresh blessing arrives in their life.
A blessing, not a punishment.
Exactly. I've felt this in my own life. Let's say you cut a corner at work. You do something slightly unethical to get ahead. You know it's wrong, but you do it.
Right.
And instead of everything falling apart, you get a promotion the next day. Or you get a massive bonus.
And what does that comfort do to your soul?
It completely masks the rot. You are so happy about the blessing, so validated by the success, that you completely forget the guilt. You forget to repent.
Yeah.
You look at your bank account, you look at the ease of your life, and you think to yourself, things are going great. God must be happy with me. I must be doing everything right.
But the comfort is the trap.
Yes.
The ease is not a proof of innocence. Oh. The ease is the rope being let out inch by inch, giving you enough slack to wander entirely off the path.
Wow.
The gift they received was actually the quiet seizure of their soul.
It makes you look at periods of uninterrupted success in a completely different, much more careful light.
It should.
Ease might be the quietest, most subtle form of spiritual danger. When things are hard, you are awake. When things are easy, you might be on the slow rope.
It is the ultimate test of awareness. Are you awake to your freedom and actively using it to align with the good? Or are you just coasting on the slow rope of your own habits?
Okay, so we've navigated the practical reality. We are free. We are accountable. Our choices are real causes passing through our awareness.
Yes.
But we aren't done. At the very end of the treatise, Alame, does something breathtaking.
He really does.
He lifts our perspective up from the valley floor, past the middle altitudes of Kadar, and human free will, all the way to the absolute summit of reality.
This is the final turn. The Unitarian view.
The
grand unified theory of existence that this entire book has been climbing toward. From the highest possible vantage point, the absolute summit of reality.
Yeah.
All acts are God's.
Wait, I thought we just spent 20 minutes proving that my acts are mine so I can be blamed for them.
We did. And they are.
Okay, good.
From the perspective of the valley floor, the blame test holds absolute sway.
Right.
But just as we learned in Deep Dive 3, that all the names and all the perfections ultimately belong solely to God, and all a being is God's. At the absolute summit, the question, is this act mine or God's, dissolves.
It dissolves.
The answer everywhere in the universe is God's.
But how does that not collapse us right back into the puppet trap?
Yeah.
To job JBR.
Because it is a matter of spiritual realization, not mechanical compulsion.
Spiritual realization.
Think about the greatest saints, the prophets, the completely purified souls. They don't lose their free will. They don't become autonomous. Instead, they exercise their free will to empty themselves. They empty themselves of ego, of selfish desire, of the illusion of independent existence so completely that there is no separate them left obstructing the deed.
They become a clear pane of glass.
Beautiful. Yes.
Let's expand on that. When you look at a stained glass window, you see the brilliant reds, the deep blues, the intricate lead framing.
Mm-hmm.
You are seeing the limitations, the specific design of the glass itself. That's us. We are stained glass.
We are.
The light of God passes through us, but it takes the shape of our choices, our flaws, our colors. We own the resulting pattern. We own our acts.
Yes. But when the glass is perfectly clear, flawlessly polished, you don't notice the glass at all.
Right.
You just see the blazing light pouring through it. The glass is still there. It hasn't ceased to exist.
It's still glass.
But its will is so perfectly aligned with the light that it offers no resistance, no distortion.
When Moses stood at the burning bush, the voice coming from the fire said, I am your Lord.
Yes.
The physical bush wasn't God. God isn't a shrub.
Yeah.
But the bush was so completely surrendered, so entirely empty of any independent claim to reality, that God's act simply showed through it without a single ripple of distortion.
The deeper the self is emptied, the more plainly the one true agent acts.
Yeah.
The prophet's hand throwing dust in a battle is literally called God's hand in the Quran. Quote, you did not throw when you threw, but God threw. That is the summit.
That is a devastatingly beautiful concept. But if I try to hold on to it logically, to map out exactly where my will ends and God's begins at that summit, my brain starts to short circuit.
It is almost impossible to hold logically. And the Imams knew this perfectly well.
They did.
There is a famous story of a student named Mizam who was pressing Imam al-Sadiq on this exact point.
Okay.
He understood the formula. Not compulsion, not delegation, but the matter between the two matters.
Amir Baina Alamrain, Anar Baina Alamrain.
Right. But he wanted to see behind the curtain. He kept asking, but what actually is it then? How does the summit actually work? Give me the mechanics.
He wanted the math. He wanted an x-ray of the divine will.
And Imam al-Sadiq, in a gesture of profound mercy, turned his hand over two or three times in the air, and he looked at Mizam and said, quote, if I answered you, you would fall into disbelief.
If I answered you, you would fall into disbelief.
It wasn't a refusal born of stinginess. He wasn't hiding a secret to hold power over the student. It was an act of pure kindness.
Because some depths of this ocean simply cannot be handed across in a sentence without drowning the person trying to receive it.
Exactly.
If you try to hand a finite, valley-dwelling mind the infinite summit-level mechanics of divine unity, the mind shatters.
It cannot hold the paradox.
It either turns God into a tyrant falling into Job, J-I-B-R, or it turns itself into a God falling into Tafweed.
Which brings us in a perfect circle, right back to the cold open of our discussion.
Yes, it does.
What did Ali tell the desperate man who demanded to know the secret of destiny? Quote, "It is a deep ocean. Do not enter it." The ultimate truth of how God's absolute agency and our genuine freedom effortlessly coexist at the summit is a mystery we are meant to live inside of, not a puzzle we are meant to solve on paper.
So how do we live inside of it? What is the practical takeaway from all this metaphysical vertigo?
It's a fair question.
I think this treatise doesn't hand you a tidy solution you can put in your pocket. Instead, it hands you a way to live on the water without drowning.
Two grips.
Yeah.
You have to hold two grips at exactly the same time with equal strength.
The first grip, you must act as though everything depends entirely on you.
Right.
Because in your realm, it does. Your choice is a real cause. It is a cause that runs through a knowing, responsible self.
Yes.
The moral weight of your life is genuinely on your shoulders. You have to own your failures completely. Going back to our analogy, the hole in the sweater is yours. Do not blame God for your cruelty, your laziness, or your cowardice.
And the second grip. You must trust as though everything depends entirely on God.
Because at the summit, it does.
Because it does. The being, the energy, the raw reality of every good thing you ever managed to accomplish is His. It is all on loan.
Borrowed light.
You can take no private credit for your gifts, your intelligence, your luck, or your very capacity to do a good deed.
Because the wool was never yours to begin with.
Never yours. The blame test keeps you honest in both directions. You blame yourself for the sins, you credit God for the height and the health.
And you watch always for the slow rope.
Yes.
That terrifying stretch of ease that quietly talks you out of your need for repentance.
The God we are encountering in this book is not a dark fate looming over you with a scythe, and He is certainly not a passive spectator who wound up the clock and left the room.
No.
He is the one infinite reality in which your real, free, accountable choices are happening right now. He is nearer to you than the very deliberation by which you are choosing your next word.
It is a stunning architecture of reality, and we aren't even quite at the bottom yet.
No, we are not. Because next time, we reach the conclusion. Our next deep dive will be the final installment on this book.
Yes, it will.
It covers the treatise called The Intermediaries.
The Intermediary. So we are going to explore everything that sits between the unbounded God and the physical world in your hands.
The throne, the footstool, the pen, the tablet, the seven heavens, the ranks of angels.
And even the strange, tragic figure of Satan, Iblis. We are going to look at the entire unseen staircase by which the one light we met in our first deep dive reaches all the way down to you.
It is going to be the architectural completion of everything we've built so far.
But before we get there, I want to leave you with one final provocative thought based on everything we uncovered today about the wool and the hole.
Okay.
I want you to think about the people in your life right now, especially the ones who frustrate you, the ones who have hurt you.
We all have them.
If every genuine good they possess, every talent, every fleeting moment of kindness, their very existence is God's wool on loan, and every flaw they exhibit every time they let you down is simply a hole, a lack of that wool, how does that change how you judge them?
That changes everything about human grace.
When someone wrongs you today, what if you viewed their action not as a dark, malicious energy attacking you, but simply as an empty space?
A privation.
A tragic privation. A gap where mercy failed. A tear waiting for the light to be woven back in. How much easier would it be to forgive a hole than to fight a demon?
It is a deep ocean.
Do not drown in it, but do not pretend it is a puddle.